Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Cope Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Your body is unique. So why would you settle for a weight loss plan that's one size fits all? Noom is the weight management program that takes into account your biology to build a custom plan just for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Hello.
Hello, Aaron. What have you got for us this week on the show?
Very excited about our guest this week. When I told Max I was doing it, Max claimed that we had already had this guest on, but we have not. And that is always a good description of an ideal guest, someone we can't believe that we have not had on before. My guest is Max Chafkin, who I guess when I first became aware of his writing, he was writing for Fast Company. He's now at Bloomberg, and he has a new book out called The Contrarian about Peter Thiel, and it is juicy. And I wanted to talk to him about it, so I did.
I know you like to talk about Peter Thiel. I've talked to you about Peter Thiel. I can't imagine what it was like for you to talk to someone who actually knows anything about Peter Thiel.
This book's got some pretty great anecdotes in it. Literally before this, I was looking at the title and I landed on a annotation, and the annotation was just an attribution for a quote, assless chaps. So there's at least one reference to assless chaps in this book about Peter Thiel. That's all you need to know to listen to this interview.
Feels like a perfect segue to just mention our new partnership with Vox. That's who we're making the podcast with these days. They've been great, and it's a delight.
Thanks, Vox. And now here's Aaron with Max Chafkin.
Welcome, Max Chafkin.
Hey, Aaron. How you doing?
I'm good. I wanted to talk to you because you have a new book about Peter Thiel. But in prepping for this interview, I dug into your long-form archive and noted that you have a piece about Twitter published in 2008, while Twitter was still, I think, subletting desks in their office space. Were they the buyer, or were they the subletters, or were they being subletted from in that story?
Oh my God. I'm trying to remember. I think they were subletting it from another company that was owned by Ev Williams, maybe. I could recreate the layout of the office. I think I could draw it, but I can't remember the specifics of the arrangement. I mean, it's really weird because, like, I haven't read that, gone back to that story in a while. But you know, everything Twitter had been around for a couple of years, I think, at that point. So, like, on some level, I felt like I was late to the story or something, which I guess is how it always is. But like, the grammar and the vocabulary in that story is all wrong in retrospect. Like, I think I called them Twitters instead of tweets because, like, there was not a settled rule of whether, like, the output on Twitter should be called a tweet or a Twitter. And I got in a huge argument with Copy Desk at the time, like, in defense of my choice, which obviously, like, was the wrong choice. They're tweets, not Twitters, as it turns out.
When you're stepping into a situation like that, where you may have the perception that you're late, but history will show that you're extremely early, and you don't really know sort of where you are on the swing of a company's trajectory, What do you do with that, like, as a writer? And how do you think about gauging where you are on the curve and sort of trying to communicate that to a reader?
This is probably, like, a self-serving assumption. But, like, I sort of always assume it's, like, never too late. I mean, especially if something is still growing. And so that's sort of what I told myself, like, going into the Twitter piece. Like, oh, yeah, this is, like, big with like, tech people, but it hasn't gotten big in the larger world yet. And that, you know, usually works, although of course it doesn't always work. You get it wrong and then you end up writing, like, you know, there are a lot of embarrassing, or in retrospect embarrassing, magazine stories that have been written that are just like talking about something as if, you know, it's the next big thing, and of course it's, you know, it's actually, you've caught it on the wrong end of that. But I don't know, I mean, I always think, like, journalists too often think the story has already passed them by, and usually it hasn't. Like, actually, you know, the news moves quick, but I think, like, I don't know, like, there's always more to say. And, you know, I mean, there's always, like, a history. There's always more that hasn't been written, I think.
So you wrote that story for Inc. magazine. Tell me about how you managed to get into writing about startups in the first place. That's kind of like the beginning of the startup journalism industrial complex.
Yeah. That story came out in 2008. So I started my career in, like, 2005. So 3 years before that story came out. And, you know, I was, like, a fact checker at Inc. And I think probably just because, like, I was the young person or something, I was, like, allowed to cover tech because, like, nobody was interested in it. And I just had been interested in that world, like, as a reader, like, you know, reading Wired in high school, and just sort of being interested in, like, programming and hacking. I mean, I'm not a hacker, but interested in reading about that stuff. And so I just sort of fell into it, and it was like a process of elimination or default or something. There was just nobody else who wanted to do it.
So I would describe it as a magazine sort of aimed at entrepreneurs. So it, in some ways, stands outside of a lot of the coverage of the tech industry that's been heavily critical. This is more a magazine for people who might be aspiring to enter that industry. How did that affect your sort of development as a writer? And how did you think about that perspective going into those stories?
So I was just to think about it in my head, like, it's like runner's world, but for entrepreneurs, you know, like, I'm a runner and you know, it's like, you get the, like, here are the best shoes and, you know, here are some new training tactics. And yeah, obviously that's, like, a really different place that a lot of people, like, approach journalism. You know, I didn't approach it, especially not initially, as like, oh, I'm here to, you know, hold people in power to account. I mean, you know, there are ways, right, that when you work at a service magazine, you can tell yourself you're not just, like, you know, you're doing good for the world. Like, most of these small business owners, they're not people in power. They're people who need lifting up. So I told myself that. But no, I mean, yeah, initially it's just trying to sort of empathize with what business people are going through. And I liked that at the time, just because empathy is a good way to, like, you know, relate to another human. And I also just think small business and writing about, like, that part of the economy is something that's just, you know, hugely important. And there are lots of, you know, really cool stories in there that speak to the real life that most people live, as opposed to, you know, whatever, like, a lot of business coverage is focused from an investing perspective, which, you know, I work at Bloomberg now, and Bloomberg is very much committed to catering to investors and also to, you know, to writing about people in power and publishing, you know, important investigations and stuff. So it's, I definitely think both are important, but I don't know, it gave me a different perspective. And I certainly, you know, drifted away from that. Like, I don't really, you know, I'm not doing service journalism anymore, at least not in the kind of strict sense. Although I think a lot of really great journalism could be described as service journalism. It's a little bit removed from the runner's world thing, but where you're explaining some piece of the world to people and helping them, you know, make sense of their lives. And I think that people tend to kind of look down on that kind of work, but I think it can be really powerful and moving and et cetera.
I think the most memorable piece that I read from you during that ink run, I think this was for Ink, I hope I am not wrong about this, was you wrote about this Israeli electric car startup called Better Place. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, Better Place. Yeah. Now, it was actually for Fast Company, but it was kind of in the that same period.
Same parent company. I'll allow it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess I wonder if you could talk about that, like the default experience for a tech business is most things just fail. What did you find in writing about a big failure?
Yeah. So it was an Israeli company that was, competitor to Tesla. It's, been forgotten now with Tesla's success. But their idea was they were going to have these like cheap electric cars, and the batteries were going to be swappable. Instead of having a car that you charge, you would bring it to basically like a gas station, and they would take the battery out of the bottom of the car and put a new battery in, in like 5 minutes. And which is, that's a clever idea and whatever. It's kind of interesting on its own. Part of the reason Better Place became this, failure that burned through like $1 billion is because the founder of the company was kind of on the Davos, circuit. And he told a story that wasn't just about like technology. It was about bringing peace to the Middle East. So the fact that the company was Israeli, the fact that they were coming up with an alternative to oil was like a big part of the pitch and a big part of the reason that the Times' Thomas Friedman wrote a column in praise of them. Shai Agassi, this guy, showed up at TED, I believe. A bunch of these kind of, Davos era, where you're breathing the rarefied air. And, I like that story, I think, was kind of cool because there's like an investigative element of it. You're trying to understand how this company blew through all this money and how people were able to get, so diluted or whatever. But of course, like a story like that can have value to people who are in that world. I for years I was getting like messages from people at other companies who were talking about how it really rang true. Cause when companies are being wasteful and doing dumb things, I think they kind of tend to look similar, right? They're sort of believing their own bullshit and as a result, like hiring all sorts of people they probably shouldn't hire, like a chief philosophers and, or whatever. And so the other thing, I mean, that story just personally for me was a cool experience because I think there's like a really good way to come up with story ideas where you basically just look for people who've given TED Talks and figure out like what they're lying about. And there's also a tendency, I think, in the press or whatever to pump up these startups based on those stories. So I just think it's like it's a worthwhile thing to examine. It's like worth taking a critical look at these, stars of the moment, because often there's not as much there as we think. And, if you're talking about Theranos or something, there's like, there's some potential to do harm, but also it means that, maybe more worthwhile efforts are not getting, are not getting the attention they deserve because they're not pretending that they're going to like bring peace to the Middle East. They're just trying to like, make a nice electric car. And, probably the guy who's just trying to make a nice electric car, or the woman who's trying to make a nice electric car is going to win rather than the one who's going to try to make a nice electric car and have an amazing TED talk about, bring peace to the Middle East.
How do you start doing that research? Like, how do you corroborate the claims being made by a company yourself?
Right. Well, a lot of times, I mean, two big things. Like, one is, talk to employees, former employees. I think employees are often probably more sensitive to bullshit than anybody else, right? Like, their bullshit meter is probably like a little set, like almost even a little bit too high. I think we all tend to, look out for hypocrisy. But often, like, they're just like huge internal consistencies. It's not like to start digging or to start wanting to look into something like this, you don't even necessarily have to like look beyond the thing itself. Like, I mean, there were with that Better Place story there, there were just like huge red flags. I mean, they weren't selling any cars. It wasn't clear where the money was. You know, there's like so I think like the first step is just to look for, you know, internal consistency. It does the actual thing they're saying like make any sense? And often it doesn't. And of course, you can go deeper than that, and that doesn't necessarily apply to every story. But I think that's like the most important thing. It's just like being a critical reader.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Most weight loss programs focus on restriction and inflexible routine, which is why most diets fail. But Noom isn't a diet. It's a weight management program that uses psychology and biology to help you develop healthy, sustainable habits. Noom believes that weight loss starts with the brain, and their daily lessons are tailored to help users understand the science behind food cravings and eating choices. Whether you want to lose weight, increase physical activity, meet a health goal, or simply change the way you think about food, Noom can help you build healthy habits while still enjoying your favorite foods. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Well, this comes into play multiple times in Peter Thiel's story, where the press did quite a bit to make it seem like they had this evil genius technology when, at least according to your reporting in the book, it seems like early on the Palantir software barely did anything. It was mostly marketing hype.
Yeah, and that's my assessment. And I mean, let me give you a quick kind of synopsis of the Palantir story, and then I'll kind of explain how I came to that conclusion. So Palantir was Thiel's idea. It grew out of some technology that PayPal had developed, or it's not really technology, more like an approach to dealing with fraud. PayPal, of course, it's a payments company. You got to deal with, you know, money launderers, credit card thieves, etc. They came up with this sort of network system for figuring out who was a bad guy and who was, you know, a legitimate eBay seller or whatever. And Thiel's idea, which was really, you know, smart, was, you know, wake of 9/11, suddenly there is a lot of enthusiasm about data mining, a feeling that our failure to do, you know, adequate network analysis is part of what led to, you know, us failing to stop 9/11. And hey, here's this technology, or like I said, not quite a technology, more like an approach to finding bad guys. And let me sell it to the military. And one of my big kind of like theories about this, about Silicon Valley and a lot of the important figures in Silicon Valley, and this applies to Thiel, but it doesn't just apply to Thiel, is that, you know, people tend to assume that these tech companies are run by like great technologists, and sometimes they are, but a lot of tech people who are seen as, you know, brilliant or whatever are also great marketers. I mean, I think like Elon Musk, right, is like, I'm not an expert, right, in rocket science, but I can tell you, like, he's an amazing marketer, and his ability to sell stuff is really incredible. And same thing with Peter Thiel. I mean, it's kind of a weird thing to say about a guy who's affect is so introverted or whatever, but like I think he's told this incredible story about himself, and that has included this Palantir thing that you're bringing up.
You know, when you take an idea like that the Palantir software was kind of smoke and mirrors early on, tell me how you found that out.
The way this was covered was that Palantir was, you know, Big Brother. I mean, I literally think Forbes did a story that was like, meet Big Brother. And, you know, that was, of course, the aspiration, but it wasn't necessarily what they were at the time. And the thing that really unlocked this for me, I mean, there was some really good reporting. So the thing I'm doing first and foremost is just trying to read everything that's out there and try to read it critically. And if you looked at the reporting, there were sort of two threads. There was the Big Brother thread, and then there was this kind of trade magazine-y type thread that nobody was really paying attention to, how Palantir was having trouble selling their software and how they had all these contracts. They kept announcing contracts with like Coca-Cola and, you know, Pepsi. I can't remember the specific companies, but, you know, they had these big contracts, and then they were quietly being canceled. And so there's like an inconsistency there, right? Like it's Big Brother, but no one wants to buy it. And that's what kind of got me interested in it. And I think both of those threads are worth pulling, because Palantir definitely has, you know, important implications for privacy. Like I think that, if you're concerned about privacy, it is worth being concerned about Palantir and the impact it's had. But I think especially in the early years, they were sort of making it seem like their capabilities were maybe a little scarier than they actually were. The thing that really first unlocked it for me was, you know, talking to a customer who gave me kind of a frank assessment of the capabilities of the software. And it was like, you know, it was like kind of night and day from what I had read. And from there, you know, started talking, to former employees, current employees. And, you know, the story that I heard was this kind of consistent thing, which is that, you know, for years and years and years, the company was really having trouble making the software work.
I think that there's a urge generally to use the cult of personality around the founders as a way to understand the essential nature of the companies. I wonder if you could sort of talk about your experiences around that, and is that an effective way to talk about companies, and how did it play out in talking about, Thiel is interesting because in the book you get to see his cult of personality applied to several companies in distinct spheres.
Oh man, so many thoughts on this. So I think when you're writing about, you know, small privately held companies, especially, understanding the founder's personality is like really important. It's like really hard. And companies where like a single person still kind of controls the company. I mean, I think it's really hard to talk about Facebook in any kind of intelligent way without like understanding Mark Zuckerberg. If you're a nonfiction writer, that's like a gift from God. I mean, you know, that's a character who's in every room. You know, Thiel isn't in every room. You know, having a character whose influence works differently was kind of, I guess, like in some ways a limitation, but also like an interesting challenge. And because of course influence can work in all different ways. And like sometimes people are influential because, you know, they're in the room, but like a lot of really powerful people aren't in the room. In fact, they try not to be in the room because there are advantages to working through, you know, intermediaries and through loyalists. And that's Thiel's approach. And the other part of Thiel that I think is really interesting and is that he's sort of leveraged this kind of cult of personality thing that you're talking about. I mean, he's created sort of an intellectual movement around himself. And so he doesn't even necessarily have to like be in the room because he's got this kind of large army of followers who are intellectually allied, who are for reasons that are sometimes sort of authentic to their beliefs or sometimes kind of self-interested, have, you know, strong incentives to kind of ape his ideas, to push things in the direction that he wants. I mean, you know, the PayPal mafia thing, in some ways I think it's cheeky, but I think they're serious. Like it is kind of like a mafia in the sense that it's somewhat decentralized. It's based on loyalty. It's a network. Like, it is like a mafia, and it's just kind of like a mafia of money and influence rather than, you know, protection racket or something. And I think that's been a really kind of like smart thing that Thiel's done, and it makes it hard to write about him, but also kind of interesting.
For a story that's in some ways been heavily reported already, what were the mysteries for you? Like, what were the things that you didn't know going into this book that you felt like you needed to figure out?
So there are a few things, and often there were cases where there had been like kind of a lot of reporting around it, but I wasn't really sure how much to trust it. So, for instance, you know, the Gawker case and Thiel's kind of effort to destroy Gawker Media. There had been a lot of production, you know, around that story, but a lot of it was basically one source, and it was Peter Thiel, because he had he basically found this writer, Ryan Holiday, who wrote a book about the case with access to Thiel, and it's very much, you know, it's like Peter Thiel's version of events. And, you know, when Forbes reported that Thiel had been the secret funder of this litigation, Thiel went to Andrew Ross Sorkin at the Times and gave an interview. And so, like, the actual, like, account of his motivations of what exactly happened, it was all largely, you know, based on, you know, a handful of stories where he had a big hand. Like, some of the big ones were, like, trying to figure out, okay, like, what really happened? Like, what was, like, the real, you know, motivation for destroying Gawker? What did he really do it in exactly the way that the Ryan Holiday book suggests? So that was, like, one big category of things. Another category of things was, like, intellectual consistency. Like, one of the things that, like, attracted me to Thiel as a subject is, like, everything is, like, there's so many weird mysteries about his beliefs. Like, how does a gay immigrant technologist come to support Donald Trump? I mean, you know, specifically, who did he meet with, that sort of thing? You know, what happened? And, like, you know, what is Peter Thiel and Donald Trump? You know, what are these two people? What are these two men who couldn't seem more different? You know, what do they say when they meet each other? And then, you know, there were some other, you know, weird little fun rabbit holes. I mean, Thiel weirdly had this, like, career as a hedge fund manager that people sort of forgotten about because it ended in failure. But there was a time when he was, like, the hot Wall Street guy. And he was getting, you know, written up in Barron's and the Wall Street Journal. And then he basically lost all his investors' money. And I was, you know, trying to figure out how that happened. It was a combination of kind of, like, meta questions and then sort of more, like, kind of traditional reporting questions.
How did you deal with those contradictions in sort of framing Thiel as a character? You know, the simplest one in the book being, this is a person who's dedicated a huge amount of their life to pushing libertarian causes, but is in some ways building businesses like Palantir that require a very large government in order for themselves to make money.
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, just from, like, a philosophical standpoint, like, I think the things people say, like, we should pay more attention to the things they actually say rather than, like, attempting to, you know, find the hidden meaning. I think mostly most people say what they mean most of the time. And if there's any question, you should generally assume the thing they say is the thing they mean. And that matters to me because, you know, when Thiel supported Trump, right, there were all these people who created all these insane, you know, kind of like, you know, sort of literary explanations almost to figure out, like, why would he support Trump? Like, maybe because of course he couldn't actually just like Trump, but like, that's the most, like, likely explanation, is he supported Trump because he likes Trump and likes Trumpism. And, you know, that's what, you know, my reporting bears out. It's also there in things he said. I mean, it's not like he's lied about it. I mean, he wrote this essay, you know, in 2009 that was, you know, incredibly controversial for lots of reasons, but it was all about how he no longer believed in democracy. In that essay, he also, you know, sort of somewhat famously said that, you know, it's too bad that women got the right to vote, because, you know, that's push things in a bad direction from a policy perspective. You know, it's like favor the welfare state or whatever. So I think he's got a belief system that is not all that different from the kind of like nationalist populist thing that we see coming out of a big sector of American politics. And I don't think that's a total accident. Like, I mean, I think Thiel has helped push things in that direction, both through his, you know, kind of force of intellect and also by spending money in clever and creative ways. I mean, the other thing is, and this is maybe in contradiction to everything I just said, but, you know, Thiel is at his core like a hedge fund guy. That's kind of like where that's how he got into tech investing. As I said, he had this long career as a tech investor. He doesn't fit the kind of like Silicon Valley model of either entrepreneurship or investing. And as a result, I don't know, I think he's been ideologically somewhat flexible because he's been really effective at using his ideology and his platform and his following to kind of push things in a way that will like make him money.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Well, this dovetails with something you said earlier, which is that, you know, if you have a press that writes about founders as these cults of personality, eventually that gets read by the people who actually work at the company and it becomes part of the company's DNA itself. I wonder how you think about that, how much you think that your own coverage has influenced people. And that's something you have to think about as you write the follow-up stories about the Twitters and these companies that you've been following for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the honest truth is we try not to think of it because it's pretty uncomfortable to acknowledge, right? That we're driving, you know, whatever. Like this shows up a lot in political coverage, right? Like when you cover the poll, does the coverage of the poll move the poll? Does it any? And I think, you know, that certainly comes into play here, and it's uncomfortable, and it just means that. Everybody who participates in journalism or whatever, like, has a pretty profound responsibility because the things that we write, you know, matter. And I think, you know, to the extent that there's kind of like tech pushback on press coverage, I think part of what happened, and maybe this is just something I tell myself to feel better about myself, but like tech companies were insurgents for a while. And over the last, you know, 15 years, they've definitely stopped being insurgents. They've gone from being on the outside looking in to being, you know, the actual power brokers. I mean, you know, Facebook is by far the most powerful media company like in human history. It's like not even close. And not to like psychologize Silicon Valley too much, but I do think part of this kind of like the tech guys getting mad at the press, which that's a, you know, that's part of the Thiel story. That's like Thiel's going after Gawker, you know, has to do with the fact that the self-perception even now has really caught up with the amount of power that these companies have. And of course it is starting to catch up because, as you say, you know, these employees of Facebook and Google and Microsoft and Amazon, they're all raising these issues now and they're generating advocacy, you know, from within. They've sort of figured out that their employers are, you know, some of the most powerful people in the world and need to be scrutinized. So to me, that's like an encouraging development and probably like a natural development, but it definitely, if you've been covering this world for a long time, there's a shift that has happened.
This book's really exciting, you know, for a book that just takes place in a bunch of like, Silicon Valley boardrooms. It's got a lot of operatic power because you can start to see how these niche ideas start playing out as the power base grows. So it almost feels like we're building these nation states and experimenting with different forms of the distribution of power no longer as a country, but even within these companies.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of like why, you know, in the end, like, I think it's important to write about somebody like Thiel is just, it speaks to the power that these companies have. And like, because, you know, this stuff has kind of been happening off to the side, this world of, you know, basically like trade reporters and things like that. I mean, you know, this world that I inhabited and in some ways continue to inhabit, like, you know, we didn't bother scrutinizing because, like, who cares what, you know, Mark Zuckerberg actually believes when, you know, Facebook is this like tiny dipshit social media company. But like now, like, I really care. And same thing with somebody like Thiel. And so I definitely think, like, you know, kind of like trying to understand the ideas that have kind of created these companies and like what these guys actually believe has, like, you know, real importance and explanatory power and probably help us figure out how to navigate the next, you know, whatever, 10, 20 years.
Did you have any concerns in tackling this story that Peter Thiel is someone who has put an entire publication out of business? Did it give you any pause about writing a book about him?
Yeah, it did. I think it was designed to scare people and to make other people who might write critical things, you know, about him think twice about that. And I think Thiel talked about, you know, deterrence, right? Like, that's the subtext. As somebody who cares about, you know, free expression and scrutiny of people in power and the importance of journalism as a thing, like, that's some heavy stuff. I personally tried to not let that affect me because, number one, you know, I'm doing my job. I'm you know, following the basic rules of fairness and transparency. And I didn't set out to write a negative book or something. I set out to talk about the truth, and so that is something that I feel like I can take comfort in. And also, I just think we as journalists, like, have a duty to ourselves and to the world to, you know, to try as much as we can to not be afraid.
Is there any advice you could give someone who wants to take on a litigious or combative subject? Did you go about this in any way differently, knowing that this is someone who sues, this is someone who will take this matter to a legal level if threatened?
No, because I think you have to assume that anybody you write about, I mean, I think it's probably good practice to be always thinking about the potential for legal threats and things like that. I mean, that's something that, you know, it's just a part of kind of whatever the news gathering process and things like that. So, like, I you know, whatever, at Bloomberg, you know, our stories go through a legal vetting. I mean, every book by a major publisher, you know, is legally vetted, just because, like, unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of aspiring Peter Thiels out there, right? Like, there's, you know, there are people who have picked up on the tactics and are employing it for themselves. So I don't think there's, like, I don't think there's any big secret. I mean, I think with this project, like, I really just self-consciously try to approach it like, you know, there's been a lot written about this guy, and I don't necessarily want to buy into any particular narrative going in. I want to approach this fresh and like with empathy and with a sense of truth. And I think that is, you know, I mean, it's such a boring piece of whatever. That's the most boring thing to say. But I think that's basically just what everybody should always do. I don't know. I think just like following the basic rule book that we've all kind of figured out is the way forward.
What excites you going forward? Now that you've been doing this for, you know, almost 15 years now, what is there still left to be excited about? And where do you see getting stories going forward?
Dude, I don't know. I mean, it's weird. I never knew how, you know, whatever, writing a book, everyone tells you it's going to take a long time, but you never really appreciate it until, you know, until you're there. I continue to be really interested in this world and in kind of the confluence of power and tech. I think, you know, I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but, you know, I do think, like, crypto and the world of crypto is something that is worth, like, paying attention to in that way, because like, because there's so much money, and because it's so new and so interesting, and I mean, you know, Thiel obviously has played a role there, and so I think like that stuff I think is exciting, just from like a journalistic perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bring it out. I'll just take any opportunity someone gives me to talk about crypto for several minutes, because it's the thing that's just running through my brain at all times. But I do see certain similarities in the way that the most sort of superficial coverage of the cryptocurrency industry reminds me a little bit of the superficial coverage of consumer tech startup products, where like if you would think that the failure of the Juicero product was one of the biggest stories in technology history, just because people loved it so much. And I see certain similarities in the way that, you know, people cover NFT trading and some of the more pop cultural elements of cryptocurrency. And in some ways it's a great dodge around the smoldering ball of power and money that's being built, to talk about the lighter side of. And I wonder, like, how you think about that in choosing your own stories. Like, how do you balance that sort of destructive power capability to destroy everything versus this one's going to make them laugh kind of coverage?
Oh, man. Like the Juicero thing, I kind of feel like, not to defend the media here, but, you know, like I kind of think that was like, I think the media, you know, treated that kind of appropriately. And it was just so funny that, you know, it sort of took off and became a meme or something. I don't know. I sort of feel like if you look back at the original coverage of that, it's proportional. It's not treating it as if it was like this gigantic thing. But I don't know. I take your point. And I do think, like, I mean, to me, what's really interesting, and I've been thinking about this more since I've been at Bloomberg and been more exposed to like the world of finance. It's this like really like arcane world where there's like, it's got its own language. It's got these like kind of mysterious practitioners. It's like pretty intimidating if you're on the outside, and like most tech people like don't really like understand it super well. And I think that's like a really big opportunity. Like, I think that's part of what is appealing in crypto to a lot of the people who are getting into it. And it also means it's like really hard to cover, because like, do you treat it as a, you know, finance phenomenon? Do you treat it as like an investing phenomenon? Do you treat it as a technology? It's phenomenon. It's kind of all three. And as you say, especially now with the, like, you know, there is this like big interest group of crypto heads who will basically read, you know, who are in some ways directing the coverage now at this point. Like, there's certain crypto stories, right, that guarantee to get a lot of clicks because there's this kind of like built-in audience. Like, it's big, they're engaged, and like if you cater to them, you can do pretty well. And so that creates challenges, like when you're trying to reach people who are outside that audience, and also trying to just like cut through the BS and like really understand it. It's not easy. And I haven't figured it out. And that's kind of what I think, that's sort of what's exciting. And I totally agree. Like, the power aspect of crypto has been given the short shrift because it's so goofy. And, you know, it's like, it's fun. I mean, the goofy stuff is also like really fun, but, you know, I think I agree. Like, there's a whole other side that I think people are only now starting to explore, and that has, you know, they're just like real challenges in terms of how do you write about it. And that I haven't totally figured out yet.
Yeah. I feel like as a general rule, I assume that when the next thing of the scale of the internet in terms of change, and I'm not saying that cryptocurrency is that, but let's just say when the internet comes along, it will be impossible to describe to an outsider who hasn't experienced it. The terminology, the metaphors will be so nascent that the early coverage of it will look like the early coverage of the internet. And we can see like little versions of this all over the place. Like, it's so hard to describe Gamergate to someone who is not extremely online. Like, these things that are are really big events in terms of where the world is going. If you don't have the sort of proper grounding in them, it's almost like you'd need a 500 pages of backstory to even get to the start of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And like when you go back and read, I spend a lot of time, reading old coverage of, from the 90s, right? Of the original .com boom. And as you say, like a lot of it's wrong. And like, even the stuff that's right, it doesn't seem right at the time. Right. Like it's like you could just like knock it out of the park. But there's like a pretty good chance that no one will even notice, or if they know, or if they notice, they'll think you're totally wrong. There were some like great, there was a story written in like 1996 in Fast Company that like really described the kind of like teal ideology and this whole like ideological thing that was happening that happened for like 30 years. Like it really got it like, pretty on point. And I had never heard of it, I don't think sometimes like even being right doesn't matter if like the rest of the world, like, whatever, hasn't caught up. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know what the next, like, I don't know, like as journalists, like it's hard to know like where to like to direct your energies, because I don't know. There's a tension between, what audiences want and like, I don't know what is ultimately going to be the most interesting and fulfilling and all that. But I am really excited to like actually get in and like, start writing some stories again. I miss magazine writing is so much fun. And I don't know, in some ways, whatever, book writing is fun, but there is something kind of special about the kind of like quicker pace of like a magazine story.
Well, thank you so much for this interview.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was really fun. I'm glad we got to hit the crypto thing. I was getting worried when you hadn't, nasty.
I want to let people bring it to me. If I start bringing it to the world, I'm worried that the world will not be receptive. But I'm also glad we got to talk about it. And thanks for all the insights.
Thanks, Aaron. Really, it was really fun.
And with that comes to the close another episode of the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. This episode was edited by Jackie Sojiko. Our intern is Susan Peterson. I want to send a huge thank you and congratulations to our friends over at MailChimp and, of course, our friends at Vox who produced this show. We'll be back next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.